Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile and smart speaker. This is the James Gray Show with the Lords Taverners.
You're listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio, on DAB Digital, online or on your Alexa smart speaker. And if you're listening to the podcast, do leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Love Sport.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about the West Indies because they really have absolutely flown into this World Cup. You know, they're based at Trent Bridge at the moment and they've made that a little bit of a home for themselves. I know they're only a game and a half in, but when you look at how they've played over the 140 overs of cricket that they have had so far, they've been absolutely brilliant. That game against Pakistan, which opened their World Cup, they were fabulous. And, you know, you can see what you like about Pakistan. England beat them 4-0 in the World Cup warm-up, but the West Indies bowled with pace, they bowled with aggression, and there was something about the way they played that was just enjoyable. I think they just came out and basically tried to enjoy playing cricket. You always want teams to come out and look like they're enjoying themselves. But with the West Indies, I think you really believe it. You know, they've got some quite fun wicket celebrations. They always go out, and apart from Chris Gayle, who looks like he doesn't want to be there, everyone else looks like they're really enjoying being in the field. And now that they've got a legitimate bowling attack that can scare teams and that can really do some damage, you know, we saw Shane Thomas pick up another wicket today. Shane Cotterill got a couple as well. Now that they've got that bowling attack, they can really put pressure on teams. And, you know, they bounced out Pakistan. And England tried to do the same. England picked Jofra Archer and Mark Wood and tried to do the same. But that game where Pakistan beat them, having scored 348, that merely proved that Pakistan were not easy to bounce out. And it really kind of imbued what the West Indies achieved in their first game of the tournament. It proved that they're a side who not only bowl fast, not only bowl short, but they do so very, very well. And they do so in a controlled and sensible manner. It's not just run in, bowl fast and bowl short. It is, in fact, run in and bowl surprise bouncers, bowl back of a length, bowl with pace, bowl with variation. And, you know, there's plenty of batting in there as well. The likes of Chris Gayle, obviously, we've yet to see too much of him yet. We've also got, of course, Shai Hope, probably the unsung hero of that West Indies batting lineup, who also keeps wicket very ably as well. So don't underrate this West Indies side. England have got to come up against them next week, and I don't necessarily fancy England's chances, especially if they play as they did against Pakistan on Monday. But Mark Ramprakash is a man who knows this side extremely well. He was only recently let go as batting coach. He was on the Nick Compton Cricket World Cup show this morning. From his time spent with the side, he said the reason England are favourites is because they're such a complete squad.
You know, if you look back 3 years ago, England were accused of being a bit sort of one style, one gear, which was to go hard, and it works a lot of the time. But if you're going to win tournaments, there's normally a match along the way where you do have to adapt your skills. I was there on Thursday against South Africa, and they absorbed the early loss of Johnny Bairstow, and Joe Root came out and played beautifully with Jason Roy. But when those two fell, I thought Owen Morgan and Ben Stokes rebuilt the innings very, very well. So those sorts of partnerships are so important. And I think England now do have the balance. They, of course, most of the time when the pitches are good, they come out hard and they back themselves. But I think that if 280 on a day where the wicket may not be straightforward, I think they can adapt themselves and get themselves to a total now. So I think they're more of a complete team.
Mark Ramprakash there talking about England's complete team. I think what he means is that they're a team who can win different types of game. Now, we sort of need to see that, I think. You know, that Pakistan game was a sort of classic England game where it was blowout. 350 runs each side. Kind of game we've seen England win a lot. And they didn't, but they came very close. So you can sort of attribute that to a bit of a blip. But that game against South Africa, you saw that they probably didn't get that many. You know, there was a time when 311 or whatever it was would have been me sitting here going, well, England have scored 300 and that's game over. Absolutely brilliant. Well done. But in modern cricket, it's not the case. They bowled so well against South Africa, who are albeit a few batsmen short. But nevertheless, I think it proved the kind of all-round nature of this side. They've got to show mettle. You're not going to win a Cricket World Cup, especially one in this 1992 format where you play everyone once. You're not going to win it just by breezing through. You can't get on a roll. The West Indies look like they might, But realistically, that can't last the whole way, or at least it's very unlikely. So what we're looking for is whether England can start grinding out results. They've got Bangladesh on Saturday, who are obviously on a high, having beaten South Africa. That should be a win, though. At Cardiff as well, small ground, you'd think that Bangladesh's spin-heavy lineup won't be able to cope with that particular game. However, England have then got some real tests on their hands. Next Friday, take on the West Indies. 4 days after that, they've got Afghanistan. 3 days after that, Sri Lanka. You'd think that their tournament gets harder as it goes on, because their last three group games, Australia, India, New Zealand, that is going to be a very challenging couple of days. It's about a week they play those three games in the space of. And that's when we're really going to find out about this England side. Are they a side who can just grind things out? Are they a side who have different ways of winning games? We don't know yet, I think. Because for them, while they look, they're great. They know how to win lots of cricket matches, and they're the number one ODI side in the world. But I haven't quite seen yet whether there are different types of ways of winning. You know, whether Johnny Bairstow can score 100 off 120 balls in difficult conditions if that's required, or can he only score 90 off 75? Can England bounce back from that fielding display? You know, against South Africa, they were all-time good in the field, whereas against Pakistan, I would have been disappointed with some of the catches they dropped and misfields they had. Mark Ramprakash the same. He said he was surprised with how poor they'd been in the field.
It possibly may have been a touch of complacency. I mean, it's always a fine line between absolute confidence and a touch of complacency. I was really surprised with the fielding. That is not like England. They are a young, athletic group of players, particularly in the field, and they had a very bad day at the office, and that can happen.
Yeah, of course it can happen, but if you're a side who wants to win World Cups, it can't. You need to prove that that is an absolute aberration. And I don't know whether there will have been an inquest. I think it's more likely that they will have said, look, we know that that's not us, and we hold ourselves to higher standards. And a couple of them, Joe Root, Owen Morgan, Jason Roy especially, will have held their hands up and said, you know what, yeah, we got that wrong, we're sorry, and we'll do better next time. I wouldn't blame England for being annoyed, but I don't think they're the type of side who are going to start shouting around the changing room and blaming each other for that particular performance on Monday. They, of course, take on Bangladesh on Saturday.
Love Sport.
Cristiano Ronaldo had Switzerland in a spin last night. He scored a hat-trick as Portugal won 3-1 on home soil to beat Switzerland in the semi-final of the UEFA Nations League finals. The semi-final of the finals, I believe that's right. Ronaldo, of course, had given Portugal the lead, a stunning first-half free kick that wrong-footed Jan Sommer. Switzerland actually went level, and that was when the controversy kicked in, because Portugal thought they had a penalty. A man was hacked down in the box, and they went to VAR. But actually, it turned out that the referee had been called to go back a minute to look at a VAR question for a penalty at the other end. I was watching it in the pub without the sound on, right? Which, for a place that advertises itself as a sports bar, just to get slightly distracted here, how can you advertise yourself as a sports bar and have four pathetically small TVs in the corner of the room and not even put the sound on for the football? Honestly, pathetic. Actually made it kind of more dramatic for me because I didn't have a clue what was going on, so I kind of loved it. But they went back and they realised there had been an offence at the other end and awarded a penalty to Switzerland. Now, whether you think that was a penalty or not is sort of neither here nor there, because it made VAR look very, very poor. It was a very odd situation where you had the referee apparently looking at a penalty at one end and then looking at a penalty at the other end, and then having to go over and look at the screen and then giving the decision. The whole process took too long for a start, and we know that's a problem. And if you were, look, being in the pub with the sound off is, I imagine, exactly what it was like being in the stadium, except for the fact that I could see the replays that were being shown to the referee. Whereas fans in the stadium, they wouldn't have had a clue what was going on. Can you imagine? You think that the referee is looking as to whether he's going to give your team a penalty. All of a sudden, he runs out of the tunnel and goes to the wrong end. You'd think he'd forgotten who was playing where. And I think probably the players felt a bit like that as well. Fortunately, the right result, even if I didn't necessarily think it was a penalty, actually, what he decided on replay. But even if he got the wrong decision, at least the right result ended up coming to pass. Cristiano Ronaldo scored his second 2 minutes from time, and then he added a third to complete a hat-trick. I think he's now got 88 international goals, which is pretty absurd. But VAR got it right, basically, sort of, kind of, in the wrong way, and maybe with the wrong decision. But don't let this kind of nonsense, you know, the weird protocols, ruin VAR. Because it is basically a good thing. We know there are other sports where it works. You know, rugby league, rugby union, cricket, they all work with VAR. Even hockey, actually, I believe, use it. And all of those sports have a video assistant referee that works. And look, what annoys me is why we're only just having vague conversations about the possibility of some big screen showing the replays. Why are we only just having that conversation? Surely, the first time they trialled it, one of the things they realised, even if they hadn't trialled it in front of fans, they must have realised, this is quite confusing if you're not actually the referee. Because even players are probably a bit baffled. Even players. And yet when you go to the rugby, you get the referee gets a buzz in his ear and the video assistant referee says, or the TMO as they call him, oh, could you have a look at this? And they put it up on the big screen, the ref can see it, the two assistant referees can see it, they make a decision as a trio and it works. So why on earth wouldn't football look at that and go, we're trying to work out how best to use video assistant referees. Well, let's just guess. Because that's what they basically appear to have done. They've basically been guessing as to how best they can use it. Whereas if they had done a little bit of research, had a bit of a ring around, maybe spoken to someone at the RFU and said, oh, lads, what do you think about using the old TV, the old technology in the year 2017, you know, many, many years after it was available. Maybe if they'd had the sort of prescience to ask someone whether it was the best way of doing things, then they wouldn't have encountered these problems. It's a classic situation of finding the right solution and coming at it completely the wrong way, which is incredibly frustrating if you just want to watch football.
Love Sport.
It's not been a great week for Spurs fans. First, they lost the Champions League final, and much as there were positives to take away from that, essentially, it was a bad night. And now they're staring down the barrel of, frankly, I think what we've all known for a while, which is that Christian Eriksen looks more than likely to walk away from the club this summer. Says he's ready for something new. If I have to go, then hopefully it'll be a step up. Let's speak to former Spurs defender Brian Statham, who's on the line now. Brian, do you think this has been coming? Have you seen Christian Eriksen leaving the club as something of an inevitability?
Sadly, yes, I have. Yeah, I mean, he's clearly a top player for Spurs and has been for a number of years. So I'm not surprised by it. That being said, I'm a little bit surprised by the announcement and what he's actually said. He's almost saying, I'd like to leave, but if nobody comes in for me, then I'll stay. So as a fan, you're thinking, well, where is your allegiance? You know, you've got the Spurs badge on your chest, but you're saying you might stay if nothing else better comes along, which, you know, it didn't feel right to me.
Do you think there's something to be said for Spurs tying this up last summer? Surely if they'd done a deal, you know, we understand he's still on 70 grand a week, which for the quality of player he is in the modern market is a bit of a farce. But if they'd done a deal for him with a new contract last summer, even a year extension or 2 year extension, they wouldn't be in this situation, would they?
No, they wouldn't. So what does that come down to? That comes down to the player. I'm pretty confident that Daniel Levy and those around him would have been doing their utmost to have Eriksen on a new deal on 100, 120, whatever that number might be, and secure him on a longer term 4 or 5 year deal. So that feels to me as if the player and his agent and his party that look after him have said, we're not signing a new deal. We get to the stage where he's 28 with a year left, and we're now in a situation where we can say to the club, look, I'm either going to be sold now, or I go for free at 29, which is a bit of a risk, but he's almost backed the club into a corner.
How hard do you think he'll be to replace? How hard are Spurs going to have to work to make sure that they have someone else who can replace him?
Like anything, like primary place any player of that quality is extremely difficult. If you're taking somebody from overseas, there's the period of settling in, the integration, understanding the pace and the physicality of the Premier League. So getting somebody overseas is generally where they go, or clubs go. They did exactly the same with Ericsson, and it probably took Ericsson, you know, maybe 6 months to a year to get up to speed and show exactly what it was all about. So do they then look at the UK based players already, whether they be foreign or English? You know, James Maddison seems to have got an awful lot of attention at the moment, and you know, from what I've seen, I've been pleasantly surprised at what a good player he is, and so there's no surprise that there is interest in James Maddison. So that's the type of player that you could buy, so who understands the Premier League and the demands, and it just would be them fitting in with the football club's ethos.
Do you think he would be, I mean, we were the thought that if they get rid of Ericsson's 100 odd million, Maddison, I don't know, pulling a number out of my backside, 60 odd, 70 odd, who knows? Do you think he would be the right sort of player, someone who Poch could maybe mould and really improve?
60 would be pretty cheap by the sounds of things, with markets and prices the way they're going. So you may be, you know, that could be a like for like price. One goes out 100, one comes in at 100. You're buying an English player who's 24. Which is a really good age, who's had, one full year in a Premier League, but he's done extremely well. Is that the type of player that Mauricio Pochettino would like? I would have thought so, looking at the type of players that he has inherited, firstly inherited when he went there, and those that he's bought in that time. He's turned them into really, really good players in amongst that team and group ethic. There's no superstars. They are all for one and one for all. And the most important thing above everything is the team.
Looking forward, I mean, obviously massive disappointment on Saturday night in the Champions League final. But going into next season, how are you feeling about Spurs generally? We understand there's going to be a pretty large amount of spending, but what can their goals and expectations be for next year?
Well, there's going to be an awful lot of spending across all of those clubs. You're going to get the top six spend vast amounts of money. Having, when you look at the press every day, the numbers being, you know, talked about are eye-watering in some cases. So there will be a lot of money spent. Hopefully Spurs will be in that we're spending category, and hopefully spending a decent amount of money. What are the expectations? Well, Mauricio Pochettino has consistently, and this is for me a sign of a really, really top manager, has consistently got Spurs into the top four for what I think it is now the last 5 years. They've got themselves to the Champions League final. I think that was a big miss, not winning that. Whether they repeat that, that would be an incredible feat if he was to repeat that. So I don't think that's a realistic expectation. But again, I think top four would be another expectation. That's almost a given now with Spurs and what Pochettino has done. And a trophy, whether that be one of these cups. So I think it's about him as a manager and his staff working out how they win a final. They've got very close on a number of occasions. I think at times last year, maybe they put slightly weakened teams out because they were gunning for the league. So it's just finding that balance between, you know, winning a trophy, be it the FA Cup, the League Cup, and having another tilt at the title. But I think in order to do that, he's going to have a bigger squad.
Brian, thank you so much for joining us, and as always, giving us your expert insight into these things. Brian Statham, their former Spurs defender, talking up James Maddison as someone who might replace Christian Eriksen. I can't disagree with him necessarily.
Love sports.
Now, another news story that's been flying around today involves David De Gea. As you can imagine, the starter pistol has been well and truly fired on the race for his signature. United had an enormous head start, a massive head start in the race for David De Gea's signature because they already had his signature. But instead of charging out of the blocks from 100 metres ahead of their opponents, they essentially tied their own shoelaces together and then tripped over them. It was pathetic. It really is absolutely pathetic how United have failed to pin down David De Gea at the club for another couple of years at least. Or at least try and not get forced into selling him. If he walked into the office today and said, "I want to go," but he had 2 or 3 years left on his contract, they would at least know that they could get decent money for him. But with just 1 year left on his contract, what are they supposed to do? Sure, they'll get some cash for him, but they can't just keep him. They can't just sit on him. There's nothing they can do. And the news yesterday was that Gigi Buffon will leave PSG this summer. Triggered a whole new number of eminently predictable rumours, some from credible sources, a couple from not, but basically it seems pretty clear that the oil-rich Parisians are preparing to make a bid for David De Gea. Now, remember that Kevin Trapp will still come back from London. He's been at Eintracht Frankfurt this season, and Alphonse Areola is the only other goalkeeper on the books at PSG. But nevertheless, I think they will want a bit more of a marquee goalkeeper. Real Madrid, of course, remains, you would think, the preferred option. But anything is possible for De Gea, quite frankly. At this stage in his career, he's been at United for 8 years. It's a long, long time. And I know that his form has turned down a little at the end of his career at United, and I do think this is the end. I know that he's not been brilliant over the last 12 months. He's still been pretty good, by the way. It's just that he's set such high standards for himself that he actually finds now that he has to try and reach them every time. So, for him, you know, there is a body of work, to use Justin Rose's phrase. There's a body of work that clubs can look at and go, yeah, he's the real deal. Now, there was a time when a Manchester United player going to PSG and what that meant would have, especially at the peak of their career, with the world at their feet at the age of 28, would have really infuriated me. It would have drawn quite a lot of wrath in this show. Because, you know, oh, how can you turn down a top-level club in one of the best leagues in the world to go and play in a Mickey Mouse league and get paid £300,000 a year? Sure, it's a lot of money, but that money will come later. Dream a little. But that's not what this is. How can you actually criticise David De Gea for wanting to leave? Seriously, since he arrived in 2011, which is an absolute lifetime ago in some cases, since 2011, he won the league title 2 years in, 2013. And then what? He's seen manager after manager come and go. He's had a front row seat to the Ed Woodward show, which has just involved picking random different types of manager, having no real sort of coherent strategy with which to hire managers or buy players. He's watched a defence that frankly can do very little to stop anything coming at him. And while that's meant he's had a lot to do, he can't have been bored in his time at United, I'll tell you that much. Although he might be bored with the Europa League, because they've gone from being a near guaranteed Champions League team to being a 50-50. They're not 50-50 next season. I don't think they've got a 50% chance of top four next season. I think they're much worse off than that. So he's watched this team go from one of the greatest on the planet to just about a mid-table side, frankly. Because what are they now? They finished 9 points ahead of Wolves. And Wolves, by the way, are going to have the money to make sure that they can catch up with United. So if they're going to lose their biggest players, they sure as heck better hope they've got some better ones coming in. And who do we see today is nearly done as a United player? Daniel James, Swansea's Daniel James, a guy who's just played his first full season of senior football. A guy who, at the age of, what, 21, is still learning the game. He's barely played senior football. 43 professional appearances. And we hear that United are going to pay £18 million for him. Is he the player who's going to turn them from a sixth place side into a fourth place side? Absolutely not. Is he even the player that's going to help them hold off Wolves and stop them dropping out of Europe altogether? I really don't think he is. Sure, he scored that great goal against Brentford and he's really fast and Ryan Giggs thinks he's good. But is that enough? Is that really what United's scouting system has come down to? Is that it? Is he the calibre of player United think is going to change the world? Because while I admit that United have signed some people who should have changed the world and haven't, that's not an excuse for going and signing bit part players. Sure, Daniel James might turn out to be the next Gareth Bale, but United can't afford for him not to be. Every signing United make now pretty much has to be a winner because they've had so many losers. They've been downgraded. It's like when the UK got downgraded from a AAA-rated country by Moody's. Their credit isn't as good anymore, United. They're still a big club and they'll still attract certain people, but they're not a AAA. They might not even be a AA country anymore, and they need to arrest that slide fast. Signings like Daniel James aren't the type they need to be making.
Love Sport.
Semi-final of the Nations League. Of course, it means Virgil van Dijk will be up against some of his Spurs adversaries once again. They will not want to see him play as well as he did in the final on Saturday, of course. And as an England fan and a Liverpool fan, I'm a little bit torn. I mean, I don't want him to play well, obviously, but equally, I do like him, and he is one of the best defenders in Europe. So let's hope England can find a way past him. Let's speak to former England manager and now Dagenham and Redbridge boss, Peter Taylor, who joins me on the line now. Peter, Gareth Southgate is talking about not being afraid to give these youngsters a chance. Do you think that is a change from how England have maybe done things in the past?
Yes, I think so. I think when you're the England manager, of course, the results are the most important thing. You need good results. I know all supporters want you to play well. They say they want you to play well, but more importantly, they want you to win. So England managers, first team managers, you have to win matches to keep your job. And Gareth, I'm sure, very early doors went into the job knowing that. But to be fair to Gareth, he's built such a fantastic young squad and he's given youngsters a great chance every time they show consistent form, whatever club they play for. And then they come into the England squad and do well. So that's why Gareth now has got no worries about whoever he puts in. I think they all handle it. They all get on well with each other and they've got great quality. And so it's a nice situation to have.
I know you spent quite a lot of time working with England under-21s in various spells. Was it a case then of you picking up the phone at, you know, regular basis and going, well, I've got this lad and this lad and this lad and I think they're ready for the step up? Were you pushing those players to be given a chance in the first team?
Oh, yeah. When I was under-21 manager, I'd have regular meetings with Glenn Hoddle. Glenn wanted to play a certain way and we'd done exactly the same. And it was always a case of having meetings. And after every get-together, every game, you would go to the senior manager and tell him how they done. And to be honest with you, it's really a case of when I was under-21's coach, and I'm sure AD's doing the same thing now, all you ever say to the players is I'm going to be 100% honest on how you play and how you train and how you behave yourself this week. You know, so if you do everything right, that's going to go back to the senior manager. If you don't do everything right, that's going to go back to the senior manager as well. So it's up to you really to do it right and to earn that chance to get promoted into the senior team.
What have you made of this amazing rise that Southgate appears to have completely changed England around, but in quite a short period of time, or has this been brewing for a bit longer?
No, I'm not sure it's been brewing, to be fair. I think Gareth deserves a lot of credit here, because what he's done is built a very good club spirit team in the England team. Everybody seems to be friends. You know, I'm not sure that will be the case, but everybody seems to be friends. Everybody, you know, knows they've got a chance of getting in the team if they get in the squad. And I think Gareth deserves a lot of credit for that, because a lot of other managers may have looked for a little bit more experience for certain big matches. But in the end, he's gone with the squad he's gone with. But honestly, the young players, you know, the young players that Gareth has brought in, they've done so well, you know. So, you know, he's never really got a bad bit of stick, has he? Because every young one that's come in has done well. So it's been good for him. But they certainly want to be there. And I think they, you know, even now, I would say it's the time of the season where all the managers are out there are probably disappointed there's more games because they want their players to have a rest. But I think Gareth and the age of his squad, they're still young. They're still young and fit, and they get there and they want to go and play against Holland and now want to go and play against Portugal. That's the beauty of it. That's the hunger that the players have got.
We understand that Harry Kane's going to be on the bench tonight. I'm sure he's told Gareth Southgate he's fit, because if I know anything about Harry Kane, is that he wants to play just about every day if they'd let him.
Absolutely.
Do you think that's, I mean, after how he played on Saturday as well, do you think that's the right decision from Gareth to bench him?
Well, I think, yeah, I think, again, Gareth, you've got to also realise that it is the England squad, and it's a consistent squad, and you can't just make, one change because somebody's that important. And Harry Kane is a fantastic professional, great lad, and he'll understand. He totally would understand. I think what Gareth's doing there, if he's going to rest a few, which that played last week, I can totally understand that. As I say, there'd be a lot of managers out there that wish the game weren't on. So the ones that played for Liverpool and played for Tottenham, I think the two managers concerned would be delighted that their players would be rested for this game. But whoever comes in, they come in and they show a great quality, they show a great desire, so they're an important squad member.
I want to ask you about Raheem Sterling as well. That's all right. You're clearly on babysitting duty, Peter, but
you're not wrong.
I won't keep you too long. Don't worry.
No
babysitting
problem.
And football management, I imagine, are pretty much the same skill anyway, so you must be excellent.
It's what's known as being called a granddad, mate. That's what it is.
Very good. I want to ask you about Raheem Sterling because we think he might be captain tonight. There was a number of leaks, which is always amusing. But you, obviously, the man who gave David Beckham the armband for the first time. That decision, that giving someone the armband, is it used to make someone grow up, or do you do it after they've grown up?
No, I think they've got to deserve it. And to be fair to Sterling, he deserves it, honestly. And, I would have said him in recent tournaments and recent matches, not recent matches, but in matches, I would have said he hasn't performed as well as he should do for the quality that he's got. He's turned up at certain tournaments and he hasn't been there. To me, he's looked tired, he's looked nervous. But just recently, the last year or year and a half or whatever, he's been going now, my word, he looks such a good player and also such a good professional. And at Man City, they've improved him. They make him get into certain areas to score more goals, and that's what he's added to his game. But I think he's a very mature young man, So to me, he wouldn't be made captain just because he's been playing well and getting goals. I think the way that he's looked after himself, and I think he's been brilliant. So there's a captaincy there that's been deserved, and fair play to him. And I hope it happens to him, and I hope he enjoys his night.
Just finally, Peter, I know you're at Dagenham and Redbridge now, and if I know anything about football management, it's that there are no such thing as holidays. Preparation for next season, I'm sure, is well underway.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, we're always trying to recruit. We're meeting lots of players every day. And that's why, I'm meeting these young players in the morning and I'm looking after grandkids in the afternoon. So I'm sleeping well at night. So, it's all right. It's all good fun.
Brilliant. Peter, thank you so much for joining us. Always an absolute pleasure. I'll let you get on with babysitting for the afternoon. Peter Taylor there, former England boss, former England under 21 boss, an extremely long and prestigious career as well. He's now down at Dagenham and Redbridge and loving every minute, a man with a real passion for the game of football.
Love sport.
Speaking of World Cups, another one gets underway this week. The Women's World Cup starts tomorrow. We've been counting down to it. We're very nearly there. For England, it kicks off on Sunday against Scotland in Nice at 5 p.m. UK time. Let's speak to Grace Williams, General Manager at Watford Ladies. Grace, how excited are we about this World Cup?
Hello, thank you firstly for having me on the show. I think incredibly excited. I think it's been great throughout the country to get behind another World Cup after a successful run for the men. I think there's no reason why everyone can't get behind it, and everything that's been going along and getting out across the news, the TV, the radio. I think everyone's coming together as a nation and getting really excited for the World Cup.
It was great to sort of leaf through the papers this morning, and almost every national newspaper had a Women's World Cup pullout or a big section devoted to it. Is this the kind of springboard that the women's game really needed in this country to take it all the way into the mainstream, if you like?
Absolutely. I think the World Cup's come at almost the perfect time as well for women's football. It's continuously growing and it's continuously getting popular, where you've got the WSL games on BBC, on BT Sport. I think it's growing, and now having such a pinnacle tournament like the World Cup, where people can get behind their country, get behind their nation and have a look into women's football and see, okay, it is good enough to get behind the men, why not get behind just the country as a whole for the ladies? So I think things like billboards around the world, billboards through the country, in the newspapers, in magazines, in schools, on TV, on social media. It's really pushing people's interest to get behind the ladies.
And I suppose what I've always, you know, covering and following the women's game relatively closely, what it's always really lacked is a bit more depth. Now, obviously, you work with Watford a little bit further down the pyramid. Have you seen a real appreciable improvement in quality at that level in the women's game over the last year or two, maybe?
Yeah, I think they're trying to, particularly the top 3 to 4 tiers, they're really trying to use it as a springboard, getting up into the top leagues. I think if you want the top league of women's football to be so successful, you've got to grow it from the ground up, really, haven't you?
Mm.
You can't just expect the top league to have everything in there, and it is brilliant, the support they're showing throughout. I think the improvement in our leagues and into the Championship and into the WSL is continuously growing. So why not keep putting more into it at lower levels, even down onto grassroots? The FA put more funding into grassroots football for young girls, because it's got to start somewhere. They're not going to just enter in halfway between 16 and 18-year-olds.
England come in as, I believe, 4th favourites for the title overall, behind the US, France and Germany. How good do you think their chances are? They've, of course, got Scotland, Argentina and Japan in their group.
I honestly think, along with a lot of the country, the expectations are high for them. I think we can win it, completely honestly. After the success of the She Believes Cup, where we're playing already against some of the best teams in the world, we had good results, good performances, and obviously we won the cup. I think going in with sort of teams that are in against our group, I think we can get out. It's going to be competitive. I think the whole tournament itself, with the hype that it's had around, it's going to be a really enjoyable, competitive tournament. I believe that England can go up to win it, definitely.
Of course, one person who will really be missed from the tournament is Ada Hegerberg. You know, she's the Ballon d'Or winner. She's not in Norway's squad for the World Cup, on a 2-year protest pushing for equality in the sport. Do you think it's that well advised for the best women's player in the world, by common consent, to walk away from the World Cup? Does that send the right message, or would she be better off using it as a platform?
I think you can look at it from both sides, if I'm honest. I think being one of the best players in the world, competing at one of the best tournaments in the world, should almost be a given, shouldn't it? So I think in that right, the protest stands by itself, in the sense of, okay, if she's believing that for that reason, and every woman who is involved in women's football wants to play in this tournament. So it's almost giving up that opportunity, but for a reason, for the stand. However, I think if she was involved in the tournament and Norway's success and their level, maybe it could be used as a pillar to stand. However, it's their own decision, and I think everyone should support her and stand by that, and hopefully people will realise why she is doing that at such an important tournament, as to how much it actually does mean to her.
And there's also been some interesting stuff coming out from Hope Solo, of course, a legend of US women's football, sort of complaining about the prize money. We've seen prize money go up at the Women's and Men's World Cup, but all that's happened is the gap between the two has widened. That doesn't seem right, does it?
No, I mean, we're growing to always to get bigger and always to get better. I don't think, even from my point of view of being in women's football at the moment, you can directly compare the two from money sense. However, the fact that it is moving up and it is increasing, the money that's getting involved in it, the prize money, the money's being put into it and coming out, is growing. However, like you say, that means that the gap is growing, because the men's game is continuously involving with more money.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely something that it needs to be improved on. I think the value of it needs to be increased, and things like prize money is similar to the same as the FA Cup. The difference is astonishing. It's not even just a slight difference. So I think it's something definitely that needs to grow, but the interest needs to go with it. And hopefully after this World Cup, once you sort of take a step back and you realise the interest it has gained, the viewing figures, the tickets, the money that's being put into it externally, hopefully they'll realise that is a pillar where they need to start investing more.
Grace, just finally, for some of our listeners who maybe haven't watched women's football before, or haven't seen England play, who's the one English player you really want them to watch? Who should they be turning on their TVs to watch?
I think that's a hard question when we've got such a strong squad. Similar to the men, I think we've got a lot of new young players coming in. We've got people like Leah Williamson and Georgia Stanway. We've got only under 10 caps for England. I think Georgia Stanway and Kira Walsh, definitely ones to watch. They're going to be the ones, and Nikita Paris, that are scoring your goals. But you've got the experienced players like Karen Carney. For me, is our standout player through the tournament. She came on against New Zealand and had a great effect almost instantly. She's someone strong that you want to have in midfield. I mean, she herself has got over 140 caps for England. You've also got players like Jill Scott, who have got also over 100 caps. It's a good mix of a squad. You've got young new players and you've got the older, we'll say, more experienced players.
Yes, more experienced. That's the one you're looking for.
Yeah, more experienced. More that have gone through a few more caps of England. But I think altogether, even stand out alone from England, it's going to be a great tournament to watch. It's very competitive. I think every team, every country that's going to that wants to win it, and they've all got their own reasons why. So it's going to be a great one to watch.
Well, I was reliably informed that football was coming home last summer, and it didn't. So I'm fully expecting it to be coming
we
home.
We are relying on this. We
yeah,
will rely
exactly.
on the
well, football's late, but it will eventually come home. Thanks so much for joining us, Grace. An absolute pleasure to have you on. Grace Williams there, General Manager at Watford Ladies. Women's World Cup kicks off tomorrow. France, the hosts, playing the first game. But England get going on Sunday, 5 o'clock. The old enemy, Scotland, in Nice.
Love Sport.
England fans have been caught up in some trouble again. It's a familiar story, isn't it? Waking up to read statements from UK police and from the FA condemning the behaviour, and a few hungover England fans probably waking up, and I hope waking up, feeling pretty regretful, hating what they've done and regretting their actions a bit. I don't know, maybe these people are shameless. Maybe the people who go overseas on a regular basis and cause trouble for the local police don't have any shame. They've also been disavowed by the FA. They've insisted these are not true England fans, so they're an embarrassment to the team and the thousands of well-behaved fans who follow England in the right way. You can't disagree with that. It is embarrassing for the team. It's embarrassing for, as they mentioned, the thousands of travel club supporters and England fans who do go out and watch the team in a peaceful manner. Well, peaceful is not even the right word. You're allowed to make noise as a football fan. You're allowed to go and have a good time. You're not allowed to throw bottles at the police. There's an obvious line there. And I know it's true. I know that a lot of people do just following around the world quite happily. You know, I'm not convinced that Don Betts of this very parish would ever have considered going to Porto as a holiday destination. You know, there's great wine, great weather, great food. It's a wonderful place, Porto, in the north of Portugal. But I think most of the England fans who are there might not have thought about going there were England not there already. It's a way they use it as a sort of excuse to go and visit new places, quite a fun adventure. And yet there are some people ruining it for them. And apologies for the poorest tourist board, Porto tourist board sort of plug there. But it is a great place. You really should go. There's some good golf up there as well. It's really worth it, honestly. But and England fans aren't always there, to be fair. The main point here is that these England abroad problems keep happening. And the small minority of England fans who ruin the experience for everyone else is growing. Or, at very least, it's not getting smaller. And they're not staying at home. They're still going and still getting in trouble with the police. It keeps happening. And if it does keep happening, then whoever is job it is to stop it happening is not doing a good enough job. The responsibility, you would think, must fall with the FA in the end, because it's they who will be punished and therefore they who must bear the burden of responsibility. Sure, it should be borne, by the way, it should be borne, obviously, by the morons who think it's okay to chant incessantly about long forgotten and solved wars and conflicts, or, you know, about terrorist groups that were disbanded 20 years ago, or charge at foreign police, or hurl bottles at opposition fans. Opposition who they're not even playing yet. I mean, seriously. But first, before they can bear responsibility, we've got to catch them. That's the simple truth. You've got to work out who these people are. And the FA must be part of that. I know that they take some spotters, as they call them, away with them. But how much help they can be, I don't know. They try and avoid the problems before they happen by picking out the troublemakers. But frankly, it's got to a point now where we have to go further than that. Surely, we're at a crisis point here. You know, Mark Roberts, who's the Deputy Chief Constable at the National Police Chiefs Council Football Policing Lead, he says the behaviour of a small number of England fans out here continues to tarnish the reputation of genuine fans who are simply trying to enjoy the football. The behaviour we're witnessing is incredibly disappointing, and again I would point fans towards the recent video from the FA, Don't Be That Idiot. Now, the video he is referring to essentially features a fan watching a viral video of himself behaving like a lout. You're walking around a nice-looking city, chucking bikes in canals, throwing beer at people, jumping on cars while ignoring the police. Just have a little listen to some of it here.
You're part of our team. Make the country proud.
Don't be that idiot. That video is entitled, and they even got Gareth Southgate to read the last two lines. That's nice, isn't it? It's great. Look, I think it's quite a clever video and quite a good video. And to a right-minded, right-thinking individual, it kind of makes sense. And like, yeah, don't be that idiot. I wouldn't be that idiot. But that's the point. You're not going to break down the issues that grip these people who think it's okay to go out to wherever it is in the world and cause trouble, get in stramashes with the local police. So really, the solution needs to be more than what is quite a slick video. Congratulations to the PR company that the FA paid amount of money to produce that video. It's good. You've earned some of it, so well done. But it's not going to stop, you know, Dave from Stevenage or Linda from Bradford or whoever it is. It's not going to stop any of those people going out and causing problems overseas. So actually, the only solution, and Henry Winter suggested this on Twitter today, and I found it hard to disagree, the only solution is that every plane that carries hundreds of England fans overseas for an away game needs to be followed by a slightly smaller plane full of police officers. That's what you've come to now. Paid for by the FA or Team England, not by the taxpayer. Hopefully you get the same police, maybe. The same police supervisors going out, because then they can maybe build up a relationship with the England fans. And, you know, these are experienced police officers who know how to deal with these types of situations. Often, you know, police in smaller places overseas don't really know what to expect. They're unsure how to deal with it. And that can create even more animosity between fan and police. Amsterdam last year, Porto this. It's kind of embarrassing that English football fans now need to be chaperoned around the world just in case they cause too many problems. But that's what we've come to because it keeps happening. This isn't a coincidence. It just keeps happening. Don't forget that 15 years ago, England were threatened with a ban from the Euros. In 2003, UEFA sat down with FA and said, look, we'd had some incidents in Turkey. There'd be some racial abuse of fans as well as the team, fans running on the pitch. And the FA said, and the UEFA said, look, we'll ban you from Euro 2004. Frankly, as I remember Euro 2004, I'd rather we were banned, but that's not the point. They said that and they were like, look, we'll just take a hardline approach with it. They'd be well within their rights to issue a similar threat this time around, ahead of next summer's tournament. Which is a shame because we might actually win that one and the finals at Wembley. But that might be the only way to penetrate the increasingly thick cranium of those few Neanderthals who see England away as an opportunity to wage their own personal war on European police. Stay at home. You are England fans, but not that I recognise.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. Remember to leave us a rating and a review, but only nice ones. I don't take criticism well.